swept Lu Xin into a deep embrace, and felt the floor drop away beneath them. She hadn't meant to do this, but her stomach was already pitching, and her vision shifted uncontrollably, and she saw herself from outside, looking alien and wild, and holding on for dear life to her past. Then the room stopped spinning, and Luce was alone, clutching the oracle bone in her hand. It was done. She'd become Lu Xin.
"I disappear for 3 minutes and you go 3D," Bill said, reappearing in a huff. "Can't a gargoyle enjoy a nice cup of jasmine tea without coming back to find that his charge has dug her own grave? Have you even thought about what's going to happen when the guards knock on that door?"
A knock sounded sharply on the great bamboo door in the main chamber. Luce jumped. Bill folded his arms over his chest.
"Speak of the devil," he said.
Then, in a high, affected shriek, he cried out,
"Oh, Bill, help me, Bill. What do I do now? I didn't think to ask you any questions before I put myself into a very stupid situation, Bill."
But Luce didn't have to ask Bill any questions. Knowledge was rising to the front of Lu Xin's mind. She knew that this day would be marked not just by the suicide of one crappy king, but by something even bigger, even darker, even bloodier, a huge clash between armies. That knock on the door? It was the king's council waiting to escort him to war. He was to lead the troops in battle. But the king was dead and stuffed in a wardrobe. And Luce was in Lu Xin's body, holed up in his private chambers. If they found her here alone...
"King Shang!"
Heavy knocks echoed throughout the room.
"We await your orders."
Luce stood very still, freezing in Lu Xin's silk robe. There was no King Shang. His suicide had left the dynasty without a king, the temples without a high priest, and the army without a general, right before a battle to maintain the dynasty.
"Talk about an ill-timed regicide," Bill said.
"What do I do?"
Luce spun back to the dragon wardrobe, wincing when she peered in at the king. His neck was bent at an unnatural angle, and the blood on his chest was drying a rusty brown. Lu Xin had hated the king when he'd been alive. Luce knew now that the tears she'd cried weren't tears of sadness, but a fear for what would become of her love, Di. Until 3 weeks before, Lu Xin had lived on her family's millet farm on the banks of the Huan River. Passing through her river valley on his shining chariot one afternoon, the king had glimpsed Lu Xin tending the crops. He had decided that he fancied her. The next day, two militiamen had arrived at her door. She'd had to leave her family and her home. She'd had to leave Di, the handsome young fisherman from the next village. Before the king's summons, Di had shown Lu Xin how to fish, using his pair of pet cormorants, by tying a bit of rope loosely around their necks so that they could catch several fish in their mouths but not swallow them. Watching Di gently coax the fish from the depths of the funny bird's beaks, Lu Xin had fallen in love with him. The very next morning, she'd had to say goodbye to him. Forever. Or so she'd thought. It had been 19 sunsets since Lu Xin had seen Di, 7 sunsets since she'd received a scroll from home with bad news. Di and some other boys from the neighboring farms had run away to join the rebel army, and no sooner had he left than the king's men had ransacked the village, looking for the deserters. With the king dead, the Shang men would show no mercy to Lu Xin, and she would never find Di, never reunite with Daniel. Unless the king's council didn't find out that their king was dead. The wardrobe was jammed with colorful, exotic garments, but one object caught her eye, a large, curved helmet. It was heavy, made mostly of thick leather straps stitched together with tight seams. At the front was a smooth bronze plate with an ornate fire-breathing dragon carved into the metal. The dragon was the zodiac animal of the king's birth year. Bill floated toward her.
"What are you doing with the king's helmet?"
Lu slid the helmet onto her head, tucking her black hair inside it. Then she opened the other side of the wardrobe, thrilled and nervous about what she had found.
"The same thing I'm doing with the king's armor," she said, gathering a heavy tangle of goods into her arms.
She donned a pair of wide leather pants, a thick leather tunic, a pair of chainmail gloves, leather slippers that were certainly too big, but that she'd have to make work, and a bronze chest guard made of overlapping metal plates. The same black, fire-breathing dragon on the helmet was embroidered on the front of the tunic. It was hard to believe that anyone could fight a war under the weight of these clothes, but Lucian knew that the king didn't really fight. He only led battles from the seat of his war chariot.
"This is not the time to play dress-up," Bill jabbed a claw at her. "You can't go out there like that."
"Why not? It fits. Almost."
She folded over the top of the pants so that she could belt them tightly. Near the water basin, she found a crude mirror of polished tin inside a bamboo frame. In the reflection, Lu Xin's face was disguised by the thick bronze plate of the helmet. Her body looked bulky and strong under the leather armor. Lu started to walk out of the dressing chamber, back into the bedroom.
"Wait!" Bill shouted. "What are you going to say about the king?"
Luce turned to Bill and raised the heavy leather helmet so that he could see her eyes.
"I'm the king now."
Bill blinked and for once made no attempt at a comeback. A bolt of strength surged through Luce. Disguising herself as the head of the army was, she realized, exactly what Lu Xin would have done. As a common soldier, of course Dee would be on the front lines in this battle. And she was going to find him. The pounding on the door again.
"King Shang, the Shu army is advancing. We must request your presence."
"I believe there's someone talking to you, King Shang."
Bill's voice had changed. It was deep and scratchy and echoed around the room so violently that Luce flinched, but she didn't turn to look at him. She unbolted the heavy bronze handle and opened the thick bamboo door. Three men in flamboyant red and yellow martial robes greeted her anxiously. Instantly, Luce recognized the king's three closest counselors. Hugh, with the tiny teeth and narrowed yellowed eyes. Kui, the tallest one, with broad shoulders and wide-set eyes. Huang, the youngest and kindest on the council.
"The king is already dressed for war," Huang said,
peering past Luce into the empty chamber quizzically.
"The king looks different."
Luce froze. What to say? She'd never heard the dead king's voice, and she was exceptionally bad at impersonations.
"Yes,"
Hu agreed with Huang.
"Well rested."
After a deep, relieved sigh, Luce nodded stiffly, careful not to send the helmet tumbling from her head. The three men gestured for the king, for Luce, to walk down the marble hall. Huang and Hu flanked her, and murmured in low voices about the sad state of morale among the soldiers. Kui walked directly behind Luce, making her uncomfortable. The palace went on forever, high gabled ceilings, all gleaming white, the same jade and onyx statues at every turn, the same bamboo-framed mirrors on every wall. When finally they crossed the last threshold and stepped into the gray morning, Luce spotted the red wooden chariot in the distance, and her knees nearly buckled under her. She had to find Daniel in this lifetime, but going into battle terrified her. At the chariot, the king's council members bowed and kissed her gauntlet. She was grateful for the armored gloves, but still pulled back quickly, afraid her grip might give her away. Huang handed her a long spear with a wooden handle and a curved spike a few inches below the spearhead.
"Your halberd, Majesty."
She nearly dropped the heavy thing.
"They will take you to the overlook above the front lines," he said. "We will follow behind and meet you there with the cavalry."
Luce turned to the chariot. It was basically a wooden platform atop a long axle connecting two great wooden wheels drawn by two immense black horses. The carriage was made of shiny, lacquered red wood and had space enough for about three people to sit or stand. A leather awning and curtains could be removed during battle, but for now they hung down, giving the passengers some privacy. Luce climbed up, passed through the curtains, and took a seat. It was padded with tiger skins. A driver with a thin mustache took the reins, and another soldier, with drooping eyes and a battle axe, climbed up to stand at his side. At the crack of a whip, the horses broke into a gallop, and she felt the wheels beneath her begin to turn. As they rolled past the high, austere gates of the palace, sun streamed through pockets of fog onto a great expanse of green farmland to the west. The land was beautiful, but Luce was too nervous to appreciate it.
"Bill," she whispered. "Help?"
No answer.
"Bill?"
She peeked outside the curtains, but that only attracted the attention of the droopy-eyed soldier, who was supposed to be the king's bodyguard during the journey.
"Your Majesty, please, for your safety, I must insist."
He gestured for Luce to withdraw. Luce groaned and leaned back against the padded chariot seat. The paved streets of the city must have ended, for the ride became incredibly bumpy. Luce was flung against the seat, feeling like she was on a wooden roller coaster. Her fingers gripped the plush fur of the tiger skin. Bill hadn't wanted her to do this. Was he teaching her a lesson by bailing now when she most needed his help? Her knees rattled with each jolt in the road. She had absolutely no idea how she'd find Dee. If the king's guards wouldn't even let her look out past a curtain, how were they going to let her near the front lines? But then, once, thousands of years ago, her past self had sat alone in this chariot, disguised as the deceased king. Luce could feel it. Even if she hadn't joined with her past body, Lu Xin would have been here right now, without the aid of some weird, ornery gargoyle. And, more importantly, without all the knowledge that Luce had amassed so far on her quest. She had seen Daniel's unbridled glory in Chichen Itza. She had witnessed and finally understood the depths of his curse in London. She'd seen him go from suicidal in Tibet to saving her from a rotten life in Versailles. She'd watched him sleep through the pain of her death in Prussia, as if he were under a spell. She'd seen him fall for her, even when she was snotty and immature in Helston. She'd touched the scars of his wings in Milan, and understood how much he'd given up in heaven just for her. She'd seen the tortured look in his eyes when he lost her in Moscow, the same misery over and over again. Luce owed it to him to find a way to break this curse. The chariot jolted to a stop, and Luce was nearly flung off her seat. Outside, there was a thunderous pounding of horses' hooves, which was strange, because the king's chariot was standing still. Someone else was out there. Luce heard a clash of metal and a long, pained grunt. The chariot was jostled roughly. Something heavy thumped to the ground. There was more clashing, more grunting, a harsh cry, and another thump on the ground. Her hands trembling, Luce parted the leather curtains the tiniest bit and saw the droopy-eyed soldier lying in a pool of blood on the ground beneath. The king's chariot had been ambushed. The curtains before her were thrust apart by one of the insurgents. The foreign fighter raised his sword. Luce couldn't help herself. She screamed. The sword faltered in the air. And then the warmest feeling washed over Luce, flooding her veins, calming her nerves, and slowing the pounding of her heart. The fighter on the chariot was Dee. His leather helmet covered his black, shoulder-length hair, but it left his face wonderfully unobstructed. His violet eye stood out against his clear, olive skin. He looked baffled and hopeful at the same time. His sword was drawn, but he held it as if he sensed he shouldn't strike. Quickly, Luce lifted her helmet over her head and flung it onto the seat. Her dark hair cascaded down, her locks tumbling all the way to the bottom of her bronze breastplate. Her vision blurred as her eyes filled with tears.
"Lu Xin!"
Dee gathered her tightly into his arms. His nose grazed hers, and she rested her cheek on his, feeling warm and safe. He seemed unable to stop smiling. She lifted her head and kissed the beautiful curve of his lips. He answered her kiss hungrily, and Luce soaked up every wonderful moment, feeling the weight of his body against hers, wishing there weren't so much heavy armor between them.
"You're the last person I expected to see," Dee said softly.
"I could say the same for you," she said. "What are you doing here?"
"When I joined forces with the Shu rebels, I vowed to kill the king and get you back."
"The king is—" "Oh, none of that matters anymore," Luce whispered,
kissing his cheeks and his eyelids, holding tight around his neck.
"Nothing matters," Dee said, "except that I'm with you."
Luce thought back to his luminous glow back in Chichen Itza. Seeing him in these other lives, in places and times that were so far from home, each one confirmed how much she loved him. The bond between them was unbreakable. It was clear from the way they looked at each other, the way they could read each other's thoughts, the way one made the other feel whole. But how could she forget the curse they had been suffering through for eternity, and the quest she was on to break it? She'd come too far to forget that there were obstacles still in the way of her truly being with Daniel. Every life had taught her something so far. Surely this life must hold its own key. If only she knew what to search for.
"We had word the king would arrive here to direct the troops down below," Dee said. "The rebels had planned an ambush of the king's cavalry."
"They're on their way," Luce said, remembering Huang's instructions. "They'll be here any moment."
Daniel nodded.
"And when they get here, the rebels will expect me to fight."
Luce winced. She'd been with Daniel twice already when he was gearing up for battle, and both times it had led to something she'd never wanted to see again.
"What should I do while you're..."
"I'm not going into battle, Lucian."
"What?"
"This isn't our war. It never was. We can stay and fight other people's battles, or we can do as we have always done and choose each other over everything else. Do you understand what I mean?"
"Yes," she whispered.
Lu Xin did not know the deeper meaning of Dee's words, but Luce was nearly sure that she understood, that Daniel loved her, that she loved him, and that they were choosing to be together.
"They will not let us go easily. The rebels will kill me for deserting."
He replaced her helmet on her head.
"You will have to fight your way out of this, too."
"What?"
she whispered.
"I can't fight. I can barely lift this thing."
She gestured at the halberd.
"I can't..."
"Yes," he said, imparting profound meaning with a single word. "You can."
The carriage filled with light. For a moment, Luce thought that this was it, the moment when her world would ignite, when Lu Xin would die, when her soul would be exiled to the shadows. But that didn't happen. The glow shone out of Dee's chest. It was the glow of Daniel's soul. It wasn't as strong or as radiant as it had been at the Mayan sacrifice, but it was just as breathtaking. It reminded Luce of the glow of her own soul when she'd first seen Lu Xin. Maybe she was learning to truly see the world as it was. Maybe, at last, illusion was falling away.
"Okay," she said, stuffing her long hair back inside the helmet. "Let's go."
They parted the curtains and stood on the platform of the chariot. Before them, a rebel force of 20 men on horseback waited near a hill's edge, maybe 50 feet ahead of where the king's chariot had been overtaken. They were dressed in simple peasants' clothing, brown trousers and coarse, filthy shirts. Their shields bore the sign of the rat, the symbol of the Shu army. They were all looking to Dee for orders. From the valley below came the rumbling of hundreds of horses. Luce understood that the entire Shang army was down there, thirsty for blood. She could hear them chanting an old war song Lu Xin had known since she could speak. And somewhere behind them, Luce knew that Huang and the rest of the king's private soldiers were on their way to what they thought would be a rendezvous at the Overlook. They were riding into a bloodbath, an ambush, and Luce and Daniel had to get away before they arrived.
"Follow my lead," Dee murmured. "We will head for the hills to the west, as far from this battle as our horses can take us."
He freed one of the horses from the chariot and guided it to Luce. The horse was stunning, black as coal, with a diamond-shaped white patch on its chest. Dee helped Luce into the saddle and held up the king's halberd in one hand and a crossbow in the other. Luce had never fired or even touched a crossbow in her life, and Lu Xin had only used one once to scare Lynx away from her baby sister's crib. But the weapon felt light in Luce's hands, and she knew that if it came down to it, she could fire it. Dee smiled at her choice and whistled for his horse. A beautiful brindle mare trotted over. He hopped onto its back.
"Dee, what are you doing?" an alarmed voice called from the line of horses. "You are to kill the king, not mount him on one of our horses." "Yes, kill the king," a chorus of angry voices called. "The king is dead," Luce shouted, silencing the soldiers. The feminine voice behind the helmet brought gasps from all of them. They stood frozen, uncertain whether to raise their weapons. Dee drew his horse close to Luce's. He took her hands in his. They were warmer and stronger and more reassuring than anything she'd ever felt. "Whatever happens, I love you. Our love is worth everything to me."
"And to me," Luce whispered back.
Dee let out a battle cry, and their horses took off at a breakneck pace. The crossbow nearly slipped out of Luce's grasp as she lurched forward to clutch the reins. Then the rebel soldiers began to shout,
"Traitors!"
"Lucien!"
Dee's voice rose above the shrillest cry, the heaviest horse's hoof.
"Go!"
He raised his arm high, pointing toward the hills. Her horse galloped so fast it was hard to see anything clearly. The world whizzed by in one terrifying whoosh. A tangle of rebel soldiers fell in behind them, their horses' hoofbeats as loud as an earthquake that went on forever. Until the rebel came at Daniel with his halberd, Luce had forgotten about the crossbow in her hands. Now she raised it effortlessly, still unsure how to use it, knowing only that she would slaughter anyone who tried to hurt Daniel. "Now." She released her arrow. To her shock, it stopped the rebel dead, knocking him off his horse. He collapsed in a cloud of dust. She gazed back in horror at the dead man with the arrow through his chest, lying on the ground.
"Keep going," Dee called out.
She swallowed hard, letting her horse guide her. Something was happening. She began to feel lighter in her saddle, as if gravity suddenly had less power over her, as if Dee's faith in her was propelling her through it all. She could do this. She could escape with him. She slipped another bolt onto the crossbow, fired, and fired again. She didn't aim at anyone except in self-defense, but there were so many soldiers coming at her that she was soon nearly out of arrows. Just two left.
"Dee!"
she cried. He was almost fully out of his saddle, using an axe to beat down hard on a Shang soldier. Dee's wings weren't extended, but they might as well have been. He seemed lighter than air, yet deadly skillful. Daniel killed his foes so cleanly, their deaths were instantaneous, as close to painless as possible.
"Dee!"
she shouted, more loudly. At the sound of her voice, his head shot up. Luce leaned over her saddle to show him her nearly empty quiver. He tossed her a hooked sword. She caught it by the hilt. It felt strangely natural in her hand. Then she remembered the fencing lesson she'd taken at Shoreline. In her very first match, she'd destroyed Lilith, a prissy, cruel classmate who'd been fencing all her life. Certainly she could do it again. Just then, a warrior leaped from his horse onto hers. The sudden weight of him made her mount stumble and made Luce scream, but a moment later his throat was slit and his body shoved to the ground and the blade of her sword shone with fresh blood. There was a warm flush across her chest. Her entire body buzzed. She charged ahead, spurring her horse to full speed, faster and faster until the world went white, then slammed into black. Finally, it flared through a blaze of brilliant colors. She raised her hand to block the light, but it wasn't coming from outside her. Her horse still galloped beneath her. Her dagger was still gripped in her fist, still slashing right and left, into throats, into chests. Enemies still fell at her feet. But somehow, Luce wasn't quite there anymore. A riot of visions assaulted her mind, visions that must have belonged to Lucien, and then some visions that couldn't possibly have belonged to Lucien. She saw Daniel hovering over her in his simple peasant's clothes. But then, a moment later, he was bare-chested, with long blonde hair. And suddenly, he wore a knight's helmet, whose visor he lifted to kiss her lips. But before he did, he shifted into his present self, the Daniel she'd left in her parents' backyard in Thunderbolt when she'd stepped through into time. This was the Daniel, she realized, she'd been looking for all along. She reached for him. She called his name. But then he changed again. And again. She saw more Daniels than she'd ever thought possible, each one more gorgeous than the last. They folded into each other like a vast accordion, each image of him tilting and altering in the light of the sky behind him. The cut of his nose, the line of his jawbone, the tone of his skin, the shape of his lips, all whirled in and out of focus, morphing all the time. Everything changed except his eyes. His violet eyes always stayed the same. They haunted her, hiding something terrible, something she didn't understand, something she didn't want to understand. Fear? In the visions, the terror in Daniel's eyes was so intense, Luce actually wanted to look away from their beauty. What could someone as powerful as Daniel fear? There was only one thing, Luce's dying. She was experiencing a montage of her death over and over and over again. This was what Daniel's eyes looked like throughout time, just before her life went up in flames. She had seen this fear in him before. She hated it because it always meant their time was over. She saw it now in every one of his faces. The fear flashed from infinite times and places. Suddenly, she knew there was more. He wasn't afraid for her, not because she was walking into the darkness of another death. He didn't fear that it might cause her pain. Daniel's of another death. He didn't fear that it might cause her pain. Daniel was afraid of her.
Lucien!
His voice cried out to her from the battlefield. She could see him through the haze of visions. He was the only thing coming in clearly, because everything else around her was lit up startlingly white. Everything inside her was, too. Was her love of Daniel burning her up? Was it her own passion, not his, that destroyed her every time?
No!
His hand reached out for hers, but it was too late. Her head hurt. She didn't want to open her eyes. Bill was back. The floor was cool, and Luce was in a welcome pocket of darkness. A waterfall sprayed somewhere in the background, drizzling on her hot cheeks.
You did okay out there, after all, he said.
Don't sound so disappointed, Luce said. How about explaining where you disappeared to?
Can't.
Bill sucked in his fat lips to show that they were sealed. Why not?
Personal.
Is it Daniel? She asked. He'd be able to see you, wouldn't he? And there's some reason you don't want him to know that you're helping me. Bill snorted.
My business isn't always about you, Luce. I have other things stewing in the pot. Besides, you seem pretty independent of late. Maybe it's time to end our little arrangement. Bust off your training wheels. What the hell do you need me for anymore?
Luce was too exhausted to pander to him, and too stunned by what she had just seen. It's hopeless. All the rage left Bill like air being let out of a balloon.
How do you mean?
When I die, it's not because of anything that Daniel does. It's something that happens inside me. Maybe his love brings it out, but it's my fault. That has to be part of the curse. Only I have no idea what it means. All I know is I saw a look in his eyes right before I died. It's always the same. He tilted his head.
So far.
I make him miserable more than I make him happy, she said. If he hasn't given up on me, he should. I can't do this to him anymore. She dropped her head into her hands.
Luce?
Bill sat on her knee. There was the strange tenderness he'd shown when she first met him.
Do you want to put this endless charade to rest? For Daniel's sake?
Luce looked up and wiped her eyes. You mean so he won't have to go through this again? There's something I can do?
When you assume one of your past self's bodies, there is one moment in each one of your lives, just before you die, where your soul and the two bodies, past and present, split apart. It only happens for a fraction of an instant.
Luce squinted. I think I felt that. At the moment when I realize I'm going to die, right before I actually do.
Exactly. It has to do with how your lives cleave together. In that fraction of a moment, There is a way to cleave your cursed soul from your present body. Kind of like carving out your soul. It would, effectively, extinguish that pesky reincarnation element of your curse.
But I thought I was already at the end of my cycle of reincarnations, that I wasn't coming back anymore, because of the baptism thing, because I never...
Well, that doesn't matter. You're still bound to see the cycle to its end. As soon as you go back to the present, you could still die at any moment because of...
My love of Daniel.
Sure, something like that, Bill said. Ahem. That is, unless you break the bond with your past.
So I'd cleave from my past, and she would still die as she always did.
And you would still be cast out just as you've been before, only you'd leave your soul behind to die, too. And the body you would return to,
he poked her in the shoulder,
this one would be free to live outside the curse that's been hanging over you since the dawn of time.
No more dying?
Not unless you jump off a building, or get into a car with a murderer, or take a whole lot of unison, or...
I get it, she cut him off. But it's not like... She struggled to steady her voice. It's not like Daniel would kiss me and I'd... Or...
It's not like Daniel would do anything.
Bill stared at her purposefully.
You wouldn't be drawn to him anymore. You'd move on. Probably marry some dull sweetheart and have 12 kids of your own.
No.
You and Daniel would be free of the curse you so despise. Free. Hear that? He could move on and be happy, too. Don't you want Daniel to be happy?
But Daniel and I...
Daniel and you would be nothing. It's a hard reality. Okay, fine. But think about it. You wouldn't have to hurt him anymore. Grow up, Luce. There's more to life than teenage passion.
Luce opened her mouth, but didn't want to hear her voice break. A life without Daniel was unimaginable. But so was going back to her current life, and trying to be with Daniel, and having it kill her for good. She tried so hard to find a way to break this curse, but the answer still eluded her. Maybe this was the way. It sounded awful now, but if she went back to her life and didn't even know Daniel, she wouldn't miss him, and he wouldn't miss her. Maybe that would be better, for both of them. But no, they were soulmates, and Daniel brought more into her life than just his love. Arian, Roland, and Gabby, even Cam. It was because of all of them that she'd learned about herself, what she wanted, what she didn't, how to stand up for herself. She'd grown up and become a better person. Without Daniel, she would never have gone to Shoreline, never have found the true friends she'd made of Shelby and Miles. Would she even have gone to Sword and Cross? Where on earth would she be? Who would she be? Could she be happy one day without him? Fall in love with someone else? She couldn't bear to think about that. Life without Daniel sounded colorless and grim, except for one bright spot that Luce kept circling back to. What if she never had to hurt him again? Say I did want to consider this. Luce could barely muster a whisper. Just to think it over. How does it even work? Bill reached behind him and slowly unsheathed something long and silver from a tiny black strap on his back. She'd never noticed it before. He held out a dull, flat-tipped silver arrow that she immediately recognized. Then he smiled.
Have you ever seen a star shot?
18. Bad directions. Jerusalem, Israel. 27 Nisan, 2760.
So you're not actually that bad of a guy, Shelby said to Daniel.
They were sitting on the lush bank of the old Jerusalem riverbed, watching the horizon where the two fallen angels had just parted ways. The lightest breath of gold-hued light hung in the sky where Cam had been, and the air was beginning to smell a bit like rotten eggs.
Of course I'm not.
Daniel dipped his hand in the cool water. His wings and his soul still felt hot from watching Cam make his choice. How simple it had seemed for him, how easy, and how swift. And all because of a broken heart. It's just that when Luce found out you and Cam struck up that truce, she was devastated. None of us could understand it.
Shelby looked to Miles for affirmation.
Could we?
We thought you were hiding something from her.
Miles took off his baseball cap and rubbed his head.
All we knew of Cam was that he was supposed to be pure evil.
Shelby made claws with her fingers.
All hiss and rar, and like that.
Few souls are pure anything, Daniel said, in heaven, in hell, or on earth.
He turned away, looking high in the eastern sky for a hint of the silver dust Danny would have left when he unfurled his wings and flew away. There was nothing.
Sorry, Shelby said, but it's so weird to think of you as brothers.
We were all family at one point.
Yeah, but like forever ago.
You think just because something's been one way for a few thousand years that it's fixed across eternity?
Daniel shook his head.
Everything is in flux. I was with Cam at the dawn of time, and I'll see him through the end times.
Shelby's eyebrows shot up in disbelief.
You think Cam's going to come back around? Like, see the light side again?
Daniel started to stand.
Nothing stays the same forever.
What about your love with Luce? Miles asked.
That stopped Daniel cold.
That's changing, too. She'll be different after this experience. I just hope.
He looked down at Miles, who was still seated on the bank, and Daniel realized he didn't hate Miles. In their reckless, idiotic way, the Nephilim had been trying to help. For the first time, Daniel could say truthfully that he didn't need help anymore. He'd gotten all the help he needed along the way from each of his past selves. Now, finally, he was ready to catch up with Luce. Why was he still standing here?
It's time for you two to go home, he said,
helping Shelby, then Miles to their feet.
No, Shelby said, reaching for Miles, who gave her hand a squeeze. We made a pact. We're not going back until we know she's...
It won't be long, Daniel said. I think I know where to find her, and it's no place you two can go.
Come on, Shell.
Miles was already peeling away the shadow cast by the olive tree near the riverbank. It pooled and swirled in his hands and looked unwieldy for a moment, like potter's clay about to spin off the wheel. But then Miles reined it in, spinning it into an impressively large black portal. He pressed open the announcer lightly, gesturing for Shelby to step through first.
You're getting good at that.
Daniel had drawn up his own announcer, summoning it from the shadow of his own body. It trembled before him. Because the Nephilim were not here through their own past experiences, they would have to leapfrog from announcer to announcer to get back to their own time. It would be difficult, and Daniel did not envy them their journey, but he did envy them because they were going home.
Daniel!
Shelby's head popped out of the announcer. Her body looked warped and dim through the shadows.
Good luck!
She waved, and Miles waved, and the two of them stepped through. The shadow closed in on itself, collapsing into a dot just before it vanished. Daniel didn't see that happen. He was already gone. Cold wind gnawed into him. He sped through, faster than he'd ever traveled before, back to a place and a time to which he'd never thought he would return.
Hey!
A voice called out. It was raspy and blunt, and seemed to come from right beside Daniel.
Slow down, will ya?
Daniel jerked away from the sound.
Who are you?
He shouted into the invisible darkness.
Make yourself known.
When nothing appeared before him, Daniel unfurled his rippling white wings, as much to challenge the intruder inside his announcer as to help slow him down. They lit up the announcer with their glow, and Daniel felt the tension inside him ease a little. Fully extended, his wings spanned the width of the tunnel. Their narrow tips were the most sensitive to touch. When they brushed against the dank walls of the announcer, it gave Daniel a queasy, claustrophobic feeling. In the darkness before him, a figure slowly filtered into view. First, the wings, undersized and gossamer thin. Then the body deepened in color, just enough for Daniel to see a small, pale angel sharing his announcer. Daniel did not know him. The angel's features were soft and innocent-looking, like a baby's. In the cramped tunnel, his fine blonde hair blew across his silver eyes in the wind that Daniel's wings sent back each time they pulsed. He looked so young, but of course he was just as old as any of them.
"Who are you?" Daniel asked again. "How did you get in here? Are you Scale?"
"Yes."
Despite his innocent, infantile appearance, the angel's voice was gravel deep. He reached behind his back for a moment, and Daniel thought perhaps he was hiding something there, perhaps one of his kind's trapping devices, but the angel simply turned around to reveal the scar on the back of his neck, the 7-pointed gold insignia of the Scale.
"I'm Scale."
His deep voice was rough and clotted.
"I'd like to speak with you."
Daniel gnashed his teeth. The Scale must have known he had no respect for them or their meddlesome duties. But it didn't matter how much he loathed their high-flown manners, always seeking to nudge the fallen to one side. He still had to honor their requests. Something seemed odd about this one, but who other than a member of the Scale could have found a way into his announcer?
"I'm in a hurry."
The angel nodded, as if he already knew this.
"You search for Lucinda?"
"Yes," Daniel blurted out. I don't need help."
"You do,"
the angel nodded.
"You missed your exit."
He pointed down, toward the place in the vertical tunnel where Daniel had just come from.
"Right back there."
"No."
"Yes."
The angel smiled, showing a row of tiny, jagged teeth.
"We wait and watch. We see who travels by announcer and where they go."
"I didn't know that policing the announcers fell under the Scale's jurisdiction."
"There is much you don't know. Our monitor caught a trace of her passing through. She'll be well on her way by now. You must go after her."
Daniel stiffened. The Scale were the only angels granted vision between announcers. It was possible a Scale member would have seen Luce's travels.
"Why would you want to help me find her?"
"Oh, Daniel,"
the angel frowned.
"Lucinda is a part of your destiny. We want you to find her. We want you to be true to your nature."
"And then to side with heaven," Daniel snarled.
"One step at a time."
The angel tucked his wings to his sides and plummeted through the tunnel.
"If you want to catch her," his deep voice rumbled, "I'm here to show you the way. I know where the connection points are. I can open up a portal between the tissue of past times."
Then, faintly,
"No strings attached."
Daniel was lost. The Scale had been a nuisance to him ever since the war in heaven, but at least their motives were transparent. They wanted him to side with heaven. That was it. He guessed it would behoove them to lead him to Luce if they could. Maybe the angel was right. One step at a time. All he cared about was Luce. He tucked his wings in at his sides, as the angel had done, and felt his body moving through the darkness. When he caught up to the angel, he stopped. The angel pointed.
"Lucinda stepped through there."
The shadow way was narrow and perpendicular to the path Daniel had been on. It didn't look any more right or wrong than where Daniel had been headed before.
"If this works," he said, "I'll owe you. If not, I'll hunt you down."
The angel said nothing. So Daniel leaped before he looked, feeling a wind lick wetly at his wings, a current picking up again and speeding him along, and hearing, somewhere far behind him, the faintest peal of laughter. 19. The Mortal Coil. Memphis, Egypt. Perret, the season of sowing. Autumn, approximately 3100 BCE.
"You there,"
a voice bellowed, as Luce crossed the threshold of the announcer.
"I should like my wine, on a platter, and bring in my dogs. No, my lions. No, both."
She'd stepped through into a vast white room with alabaster walls and thick columns holding up a lofty ceiling. A faint scent of roasting meat was in the air. The room was empty, except for a tall platform at the far end, which had been dressed with antelope hide. Atop it sat a colossal throne, carved from marble, padded with plush emerald-green pillows, and adorned along the back with a decorative crest of interlocking ivory tusks. The man on the throne, with his coal-rimmed eyes, bare muscular chest, gold-capped teeth, bejeweled fingers, and tower of ebony hair, was talking to her. He turned away from a thin-lipped, blue-robed scribe holding a papyrus reed script, and now both men stared at Luce. She cleared her throat.
"Yes, Pharaoh," Bill hissed into her ear. "Just say, yes, Pharaoh."
"Yes, Pharaoh," Luce shouted across the endless chamber.
"Good," Bill said. "Now scram."
Ducking backward through a shadowed doorway, Luce found herself in an interior courtyard surrounding a still pond. The air was cool, but the sun was fierce, scorching the rows of potted lotus flowers that lined the walkway. The courtyard was huge, but eerily, Luce and Bill had the whole thing to themselves.
"There's something strange about this place, isn't there?"
Luce stayed close to the walls.
"The Pharaoh didn't even seem alarmed by seeing me step out of nowhere."
"He's too important to be bothered with actually noticing people. He saw movement in his peripheral vision and deduced that someone was there for him to boss around. That's all. It explains why he also didn't seem fazed by the fact that you're wearing Chinese battle garb from 2,000 years in the future," Bill said, snapping his stone fingers.
He pointed to a shadowed niche in the corner of the courtyard.
"Hang tight right there, and I'll be back with something a little more a la mode for you to wear."
Before Luce could strip off the Shang King's cumbersome armor, Bill was back with a simple white Egyptian shift dress. He helped tug off her leather gear and slipped the dress over her head. It draped over one shoulder, tied around the waist, and tapered into a narrow skirt ending a few inches above her ankles.
"Forgetting anything?" Bill said with a strange intensity.
"Oh."
Luce reached back into the Shang armor for the dell-tipped starshot tucked inside. When she pulled it out, it felt so much heavier than she knew it really was.
"Don't touch the point,"
Bill said quickly, wrapping the tip in fabric and tying it off.
"Not yet."
"I thought it could only harm angels."
She tilted her head, remembering the battle against the outcasts, remembering the arrow glancing off Callie's arm without a scratch, remembering Daniel telling her to stay far out of the arrow's range.
"Whoever told you that didn't tell you the whole truth," Bill said. "It only affects immortals. You have a part of you that is immortal, the cursed part, your soul. That's the part you're going to kill here, remember? So that your mortal self, Lucinda Price, can go on and live a normal life."
"If I kill my soul," Luce said, securing the starshot under her new dress. Even through the coarse cloth, it was warm to the touch. "I still haven't decided."
"I thought we were agreed."
Bill swallowed.
"Starshots are very valuable. I would not have given it to you unless..."
"Let's just find Layla."
It wasn't just the eerie silence of the palace that was unsettling. Something seemed strange between Luce and Bill. Ever since he'd given her the silver arrow, they were edgy around each other. Bill took a deep, raspy breath.
"Okay. Ancient Egypt. This is the early dynastic period in the capital city of Memphis. We're pretty far back now, about 5,000 years before Luce Price graces the world with her magnificent presence."
Luce rolled her eyes. "Where's my past self?"
"Why do I even bother with the history lessons?"
Bill said to a pretend audience.
"All she ever wants to know is where her past self is. So self-centered, it's disgusting."
Luce crossed her arms.
"If you were going to kill your soul, I think you'd want to get it over with before you had a chance to change your mind."
"So, you've decided now?"
Bill sounded a little breathless.
"Oh, come on, Luce. This is our last gig together. I figured you'd want to know the details, for old time's sake. Your life here was really one of the most romantic of all."
He hunkered down on her shoulder in storytelling mode.
"You're a slave named Layla. Sheltered, lonely, never been beyond the palace walls. Until one day, in walks the handsome new commander of the army. Guess who?"
Bill hovered at her side, as Luce left the armor piled in the alcove and walked slowly along the pool's edge.
"You and the dashing Doncor, let's just call him Don, fall in love, and all is rosy, except for one cruel reality. Don is betrothed to the Pharaoh's bitchy daughter, Osset. Now, how dramatic is that?"
Luce sighed. There was always some complication. One more reason to put an end to all this. Daniel shouldn't be shackled to some earthly body, getting caught up in useless mortal drama just so he could be with Luce. It wasn't fair to him. Daniel had been suffering for too long. Maybe she really would end it. She could find Layla and join with her body. Then Bill would tell her how to kill her cursed soul, and she would give Daniel his freedom. She'd been pacing the oblong courtyard, brooding. When she rounded the portion of the path nearest the pond, fingers clasped her wrist.
"Caught you!"
The girl who'd seized Luce was lean and muscular, with sultry, dramatic features under layers of makeup. Her ears were pierced by at least 10 gold hoops, and a heavy gold pendant hung from her neck, ornamented with a pound of precious jewels. The Pharaoh's daughter. Luce started to say.
"Don't you dare say a word," Osset barked. "The sound of your pathetic voice is like pumice on my eardrums. Guard!"
An enormous man appeared. He had a long black ponytail and forearms thicker than Luce's legs. He carried a long wooden spear topped with a sharp copper blade.
"Arrest her," Osset said.
"Yes, Highness," the guard barked. "On what grounds, Highness?"
The question lit an angry fire inside the Pharaoh's daughter.
"Theft of my personal property."
"I will imprison her until the council rules on the matter."
"We did that once before," Osset said. "And yet here she is, like an asp, able to slither free of any bonds. We need to lock her away someplace she can never escape."
"I will assign a continuous watch."
"No, that won't be good enough."
Something dark crossed Osset's face.
"I never want to see this girl again. Throw her into my grandfather's tomb."
"But, Your Highness, no one but the High Priest is allowed."
"Precisely, Kafele," Osset said, smiling. "Throw her down the entryway stairs and bolt the door behind you. When the High Priest goes to perform the tomb sealing ceremony this evening, he will discover this tomb raider and will punish her as he sees fit."
She drew near Luce and scoffed.
"You'll find out what happens to those who try to steal from the royal family."
Don. She meant that Layla was trying to steal Don. Luce didn't care if they locked her up and threw away the key, as long as she got a chance to cleave with Layla first. Otherwise, how could she set Daniel free? Bill paced the air, scheming, claws tapping against his stone lip. The guard produced a pair of shackles from the satchel at his waist and fastened the iron chains over Luce's wrists.
"I'll see to it myself,"
Kafele said, yanking her after him by a length of chain.
"Bill," Luce whispered, "you have to help me."
"We'll think of something,"
Bill whispered, as Luce was dragged across the courtyard. They turned a corner into a dark hallway, where a larger-than-life stone sculpture of Osset stood, looking grimly beautiful. When Kafele turned to squint at Luce because she was talking to herself, his long black hair swished across his face and gave Luce an idea. He never saw it coming. She wrestled her shackled hands up and tugged down hard on his hair, clawing at his head with her fingernails. He yelped and stumbled backward, bleeding from a long scratch on his scalp. Then Luce elbowed him hard in the gut. He grunted and doubled over. The spear slipped from his hands.
"Can you get these shackles off?" Luce hissed at Bill.
The gargoyle wagged his eyebrows. A short black bolt shot into the shackles, and they fizzled into nothingness. Luce's skin felt hot where they had been, but she was free.
"Huh,"
she said, glancing briefly down at her bare wrists. She grabbed the spear from the ground. She spun around to draw the blade to Kafele's neck.
"One step ahead of you, Luce," Bill called.
When she turned, Kafele was sprawled flat on his back with his wrists shackled around the stone ankle of Osset's likeness. Bill dusted off his hands.
"Teamwork."
He glanced down at the white-faced guard.
We'd better hurry. He'll find his vocal cords again soon enough. Come with me.
Bill led Luce quickly down the dark hallway, up a short flight of sandstone stairs, and across another hall, lit by small tin lamps and lined with clay figures of hawks and hippopotamuses. A pair of guards turned into the hallway, but before they could see Luce, Bill pushed her through a doorway covered by a reed curtain. She found herself in a bedroom. Stone columns, carved to look like bundled papyrus stems, rose to a low ceiling. A wooden sedan chair, inlaid with ebony, sat by an open window opposite a narrow bed, which was carved of wood and painted with so much gold leaf that it gleamed.
"What do I do now?"
Luce pressed against the wall, in case anyone walking by peered in.
"Where are we?"
"This is the commander's chamber."
Before Luce could piece together that Bill meant Daniel, a woman parted the reed curtain and stepped into the room. Luce shivered. Layla wore a white dress with the same narrow cut as the one Luce had on. Her hair was thick and straight and glossy. She had a white peony tucked behind one ear. With a heavy feeling of sadness, Luce watched Layla glide to the wooden vanity and pour fresh oil into the lamp from a canister she carried on a black resin tray. This was the last life Luce would visit, the body where she would part ways with her soul so that all of this could end. When Layla turned to refill the lamps beside the bed, she noticed Luce.
"Hello," she said in a soft, husky voice. "Are you looking for someone?"
The coal rimming her eyes looked much more natural than Ossette's makeup.
"Yes, I am."
Luce wasted no time. Just as she reached forward to grab the girl's wrist, Layla looked past her toward the doorway, and her face stiffened with alarm.
"Who is that?"
Luce turned and saw only Bill. His eyes were wide.
"You can..."
She gaped at Layla.
"You can see him?"
"No," Bill said. "She's talking about the footsteps she hears running down the corridor outside. Better hurry, Luce."
Luce swiveled back and took her past self's warm hand, knocking the canister of oil to the ground. Layla gasped and tried to jerk away, but then it happened. The feeling of the sinkhole opening in Luce's stomach was almost familiar. The room swirled, and the only thing in focus was the girl standing before her. Her inky black hair and gold-flecked eyes, the flush of love fresh on her cheeks. Foggily, Luce blinked, and Layla blinked, and on the other side of the blink, the ground settled. Luce looked down at her hands, Layla's hands. They were trembling. Bill was gone, but he'd been right. There were footsteps in the hallway. She dipped to pick up the canister and turned away from the door to start pouring oil into the lamp. Best not to be seen by anyone who passed doing anything but her job. The footsteps behind her stopped. A warm brush of fingertips traveled up her arms as a firm chest pressed against her back. Daniel. She could sense his glow without even turning. She closed her eyes. His arms wrapped around her waist, and his soft lips swept across her neck, stopping just below her ear.
"I found you," he whispered.
She turned slowly in his arms. The sight of him took her breath away. He was still her Daniel, of course, but his skin was the color of rich hot chocolate, and his wavy black hair was cropped very short. He wore only a short linen loincloth, leather sandals, and a silver choker around his neck. His deep-set violet eye swept over her, happy. He and Layla were deeply in love. She rested her cheek on his chest and counted the beats of his heart. Would this be the last time she did this, the last time he held her against his heart? She was about to do the right thing, the good thing for Daniel. But still, it pained her to think about it. She loved him. If this journey had taught her anything, it was how much she truly loved Daniel Grigori. It hardly seemed fair that she was forced to make this decision. Yet here she was, in ancient Egypt, with Daniel, for the very last time. She was about to set him free. Her eyes blurred with tears as he kissed the part in the center of her hair.
"I wasn't sure we'd have a chance to say goodbye," he said.
I leave this afternoon for the war in Nubia.
When Luce lifted her head, Daniel cupped her damp cheeks in his hands.
Layla, I'll return before the harvest. Please don't cry. In no time you'll be sneaking back into my bedchamber in the dark of night, with platters of pomegranates, just like always. I promise.
Luce took a deep, shuddering breath.
Goodbye.
Goodbye for now.
His face grew serious.
Say it. Goodbye for now.
She shook her head.
Goodbye, my love. Goodbye.
The reed curtain parted. Layla and Don broke from their embrace as a cluster of guards with their spears drawn barreled into the room. Kefela led them, his face dark with rage.
Get the girl,
he said, pointing at Luce.
What's going on?
Daniel shouted as the guards surrounded Luce and reshackled her hands.
I order you to stop. Unhand her.
Sorry, Commander, Kefela said.
Pharaoh's orders. You should know by now. When Pharaoh's daughter is not happy, Pharaoh is not happy.
They marched Luce away as Daniel shouted,
I'll come for you, Layla. I'll find you.
Luce knew he would. Wasn't that how it always played out? They met, she got into trouble, and he showed up and saved the day. Year in and year out, across eternity, the angel swooping in at the last minute to rescue her. It was tiring to think about. But this time, when he got there, she would have the starshot waiting. A thought sent a raw pain through her gut. A well of tears rose up inside her again, but she swallowed them. At least she had gotten to say goodbye. The guards ushered her down an endless series of hallways and outside into the blistering sun. They marched her down streets made of uneven slabs of rock, through a monumental arched gate, and past small sandstone houses and shimmering silty farmland on the way out of the city. They were dragging her toward an enormous golden hill. Only as they drew near did Luce realize it was a man-made structure. The necropolis, she realized, at the same time that Layla's mind became jumbled with fear. Every Egyptian knew this was the tomb of the last pharaoh, Meni. No one, except a few of the holiest priests, and the dead, dared approach the place where the royal bodies were interred. It was locked with spells and incantations, some to guide the dead in their journey toward the next life, and some to ward off any living being who dared approach. Even the guards dragging her there seemed to grow nervous as they approached. Soon they were entering a pyramid-shaped tomb made of baked mud bricks. All but two of the burliest guards remained outside the entrance. Kefela shoved Luce through a darkened doorway and down a darker flight of stairs. The other guard followed them, carrying a flaming torch to light their path. The torchlight flickered on the stone walls. They were painted with hieroglyphics, and now and then Layla's eyes caught bits of prayers to Tate, the goddess of weaving, asking for help to keep the pharaoh's soul in one piece during his journey to the afterlife. Every few steps they passed false doors, deep stone recesses in the walls. Some of them, Luce realized, had once been entryways leading to the final resting places of members of the royal family. They were now sealed off with stone and gravel so that no mortal could pass. Their way grew cooler. It grew darker. The air became heavy with the faded must of death. When they neared the one open doorway at the end of the hallway, the guard with the torch would go no farther.
I will not be cursed by the gods for this girl's insolence.
So Kefela did it himself. He wrestled aside the stone bolt that pinned the door, and a harsh, vinegary smell flooded out, poisoning the air.
Think you have any hope of escape now?
He asked, releasing her wrists from the shackles and shoving her inside.
Yes,
Luce whispered to herself as the heavy stone door shut behind her and the bolt thudded back into place.
Only one.
She was alone in utter darkness, and the cold clawed at her skin. Then something snapped, stone on stone, so recognizable, and a small golden light bloomed in the center of the room. It was cupped between the two stone hands of Bill.
Hello, hello.
He floated to the side of the room and poured the ball of fire out of his hands and into an opulently painted purple and green stone lamp.
We meet again,
As Lucy's eyes adjusted, the first thing she saw was the writing on the walls. They were painted with the same hieroglyphics as in the hallway, only this time they were prayers to the Pharaoh. Do not decay. Do not rot. Stride into the imperishable stars. There were chests that wouldn't close because they overflowed with gold coins and sparkling orange gems. An enormous collection of obelisks spread out before her. At least 10 embalmed dogs and cats seemed to eye her. The chamber was huge. She circled a set of bedroom furniture, complete with a vanity stacked with cosmetics. There was a votive pallet with a two-headed serpent chiseled on its face. The interlocking necks formed a recess in the black stone, which held a circle of bright blue eyeshadow. Bill watched Luce pick it up.
Gotta look one's best in the afterlife.
He was sitting atop the head of a startlingly lifelike sculpture of the former pharaoh. Layla's mind told Luce that this sculpture represented the pharaoh's ka, his soul, and it would watch over the tomb. The real pharaoh lay mummified behind it. Inside the limestone sarcophagus would be nested wooden coffins. Inside the smallest